morning, my brothers and sisters. How are you? You are going to be forced into snuggling this morning in the name of the Lord. So she's not just throwing a peace sign. What up? There's two seats up here. There's one. This man has nice pants on, good for lap sitting, I think. All right, that last part, no. Here's one up here. I'm not going to say anything until you guys move. I'm kidding. Thanks so much for working together. It's a wonderful problem to have. While that's happening, the ushers are going to... Okay, these two are taken. I'd just like to update you on how that's going. I'm a little phlegmy this morning, so sorry. The ushers are going to elbow their way through, and if you came prepared to financially partner with what God is doing, a way of showing unity with each other and dedication to God to say, I want to entrust things that matter to me, I want to be part of something that moves and works and grows, finances is one of the ways that we do that, so that'll be happening. And we're going to dive in. We're in the second week of the series called Humus. Much to some of your disappointment, it's not about hummus. We opted against a month dedicated to a dip, although that's tempting because it's kind of a weakness of mine. No, humus, soil, it's where we get the word human, humble, humility. All those words are related. It's a way of remembering in the scriptures and even in our own English language, there's this anchor in that word to keep you grounded, to remind you of what you are so you can be really clear what you're not, what other people aren't. It helps you have really healthy, good expectations on other people, on yourself, and understand where you and God, how that relationship breaks down. And so it's super helpful. It removes anxiety. It's a blessing. It gives you peace. Today, I'm really, really excited about where we're going. Some of it's kind of a review, stuff similar to what we've talked about in the past. If you've been here for a while, if you're new, I'm really excited because of the implications of what it means for us as a church and then for the faith at large beyond our walls, but what it means to be a faithful person. One of the things we do a lot around here is we try to get inside the heads of the people that were first associated with the scriptures, those that penned it and to whom it was sent. And that's not to say that it doesn't have any application in our modern context, but the original context helps you get past a whole lot of what the heck is going on here. The Bible can be very confusing. It can even seem irrelevant. If you get your head aligned with where you think maybe people were in the first century, it's very helpful to understand what it can mean, how it can be applied and seen in our modern context. And so imagine living in a world where, that sounds dramatic, doesn't it? Imagine a world. imagine a world that's run by one empire. And that this empire dominates everything it can get its hands on, like this big global amoeba. It just kind of keeps spreading. And it believes it's for the good of everyone that it dominates and conquers. Imagine that this is run by an emperor, and you're starting to see this emperor's name and face on coinage and on pillars and on archways, and they refer to him not just as emperor, but literally son of God, savior. This is how they refer to him as the rescuer, as the king. And imagine you live in this world, and this king, this emperor runs the son of God, self-proclaimed son of God, whom they rearrange the calendar for around his birth. Literally, this all happened before Christians, before the New Testament was even penned. Imagine living in this world, and then this empire sees you, a peasant, a farmer, a fisherman, not as lower class, but literally less human. Not figuratively, literally, you're a little bit less human because of your standing in society. But they'll still take your money, and so you're still taxed between half and three quarters of your income. But before we even get to temple tax and tithes and stuff that the religious people would have had to undergo, the government takes half, three quarters of what you owe. And so your family land that you've been working, you come from a long line, hundreds of years of working a crop, you work it as hard as you can to eat off of it and to sell so that you can survive. Then you get a drought, and you don't recover the next year, and the second year after the drought, you just have to admit, I can't do this, and you have to sign in shame your inheritance over to the government. Now they own it. Think of living in a world where the job options were just nil. You can either run the family business, or have you considered the family business? Imagine living in a world where they say, hey, the emperor that's running this whole thing, he's coming to town or he's coming to a neighboring big city to check because he can't text and do the internet and even make a phone call. And so every once in a while he travels around. And when he travels, you will sing his praises. You will call him Savior. You will call him Son of God. You will make an offering. You'll light some incense. You'll participate in throwing money and in palm fronds in the road. This whole celebration, you will do that. Imagine when they come to town, too, that they do bread and circus, which means they give you, the poor people, bread and they entertain you as a way of saying, you're happy. You like this. You like the way things are. And you want to roll your eyes, but you can't. Imagine being a woman who's a little bit less than human, or a child. Am I going to carry this on, or am I going to just try to get away and marry into a whole different ideology? And then your faith tradition is fractured. The one safe refuge that you would have, the tradition of your faith, it's fractured, it's shattered. You've got some people that take it this way, and some people, it's not just a little bit divergent, it's completely different. It's almost unrecognizable to the former. You got Pharisees who on their side say, you know, you should treat people with respect, you should treat the scriptures liberally, but we should take them seriously, and we should get back to living the ways of God as outlined in the scriptures and the interpretations of the rabbis about those scriptures, and that's the problem with everything, and we've got to do that. But they're in minority, because the Sadducees, they're literalists. If it says it, it's literally true, and they've completely given up in their modern context on resurrection and angels and anything that you really haven't experienced. None of that's true. And it's rigorous, but it's even fractured. But that's the majority. And then there are the Essenes who said, you know what, just forget all of this. And they ran for the caves in the desert, and they live an isolated, strict life in the name of faith. And many people are like, I don't want anything to do with that. Then there's Herod. Your one shot at representing the faith to Rome, the representative of Jerusalem, to say, hey, take us seriously. We're not just some, you know, a village of idiots. Take us seriously. But many scholars have come to call him a puppet king. He was installed by the powers. They call him king of the Jews, but none of the Jews think that. This guy's a complete sellout. He's a joke. He doesn't get it. He's making us just like them. He's trying to always sell us, and the guy's rich, and he builds and does all this, but he doesn't care about us. So there you are theologically. And then the rabbi. You've got this rabbi that says this about marriage and prayer and eating, and then you have a rabbi that says no, and they get into public arguments, and you're like, I'm not smart enough to pick. Which is it? At least the Messiah will come. Which Messiah? Which Messiah? He already came. It's a military leader. No, it's a whole string of Messiahs. No, it's a new government. No, this guy's going to come with a sword and overthrow. Even what you're waiting on for relief doesn't line up. This is your world. And then Jesus shows up. Oh, great. Here's another one. And one of the first things he does is he says, okay, I'm going to get started by choosing 12. He chooses 12 men. Now, that's loaded with all kinds of allegory and metaphor, because by choosing 12, 12 if you're a Jew, the 12 tribes of the 12 Jewish tribes, they're all different, but they're all united by the same God. They're different expressions of the same race, the same family. So there's a little bit of the 12 tribes, but also the 12 minor prophets, that they're all saying the same thing in very different ways, even different languages, but they're saying the same thing regardless of the period of time they find themselves. And Jesus calls these 12. It's one of the first things that he does. And it's fascinating, because when you think of the 12, you think of 12 guys that are exactly the same, except this one's got a dark mustache and this one doesn't. They all sit together, they all eat together, they agree about everything, all right? So let me find a row here real quick. This looks good. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, sorry, 13. Could you 12 stand up? I'm not going to ask you to do anything. Jesus chooses the 12. Now, you've got Peter, Andrew, Big James, Little James, John. These guys, these are fishermen. Their job is to go out and fish as much as they can, the best possible times, in a lake or in a system of lakes that are completely overfished, because everybody's trying to live off this lake, pay their taxes off this lake. The government is taking so that they can go inland where there maybe isn't as many lakes. They take a certain portion and they pay a minimum for it. A very overfished, like this one, these guys go out at night. Remember some of the stories in the New Testament? Throw over the other side of the boat. We've been here all night. Are you kidding me? So you've got one group of them, they're fishermen. They always stink. They've got their fingernails have fish stuff in them. They're desperate. They're tired. They stink. Jesus says, I want you on my team. Really? Yep, I want you on my team. Now, imagine that career move, all right? And then down here on the end in the white, she looks like a Matthew. So, kidding. There you go. What's Matthew's job? Anybody remember? He's a tax collector. So he's a Jew that collects taxes for Rome. If you're one of these fishermen, how do you feel about Matthew? BFF, what do you think? Now, you're part of the problem. I'd like to strangle you if this Jesus would look away. It's a huge source of tension. Now, also in this group, you've got Thomas. You know, Thomas has got a bad reputation of being the doubter. He might have been doubtful. We're all doubtful. But he's downright cynical sometimes. If you read between the lines in the scriptures, he seems pretty cynical. So you always have his naysaying. When they talk about how to run things, you've always got him, oh, that'll work. Oh, great idea there. You know, I just picture him sarcastic. They always kind of adding to the tension. And all his ideas are like, what are you talking? That's not even a third idea. That's like a seventh idea. I don't know what you're talking about. Then you've got Simon Zelotes. Now, historians are a little divided on how this would exactly work. The zealots didn't come to their prime until just slightly after the time of the apostles. But a lot of scholars agree that the zealots, what they did was looked for ways to avenge Israel, to avenge the slain prophets, to avenge the priests. And so publicly, they were very vocal about, we need to kill the people that are killing us. That's what the zealots did. We still use the word zealot this way today. But then there's Judas Iscariot. Now, we know how he ended up, but a lot of people are trying to figure out, why is his last name Iscariot? What does that mean? And there's all kinds of different thoughts about this. Is Iscariot, does that mean, is that where he is from? Well, some people say no, because the Aramaic etymology of the word Iscariot kind of means choking. And didn't he hang himself? Maybe that's what they gave him that name. But other people say, no. Judas Iscariot is of a group of people who are the Sicarii. They carry little daggers. They go into public places, and when it gets really chaotic, they go and they stab dignitaries in the kidneys and then step back and go, oh, what happened? These guys are terrorists in the name of their God. So the zealot in Iscariot may have very well had very similar ideologies, but totally different methodologies. So they would have argued about that. And here sits Matthew at the table going, who are you going to stab? And the fisherman going, I think we're for this. And Thomas going, you're all idiots. And then Thaddeus, who never did anything, right? You're like, Thaddeus, was he one of the 12? How did they do this? Our picture is they all sit on the same side of the table. They lean into each other. They wear colorful gowns and they eat bread and they get along all the time. It's not an overstatement to say that sometimes they literally wanted to kill each other. Fundamentally different ways of seeing the world. Fundamentally different ways of seeing what God should do, what they should do in the name of God. Tensions, murmurings, arguing. How in the world did they do this? It should not have worked. It absolutely should have broken down within weeks, and yet we still refer to them as the 12. Great job, guys. I told you it was going to be easy. Sit down. It should not have worked. Now, in the New Testament, in the Gospels, you find this group of people asking Jesus similar questions. Jesus, which of us is greatest? Jesus, which of us is most important? Which of us ranks the highest? Now, this may have been like arm wrestling. Jesus, which of us is the strongest? But here's what I think they're asking. Jesus, which one of us gets it? Of all the different opinions, of all the different ways of seeing the world around the table, which one of us is right? Jesus, will you tell us which one of us everybody else should say is right? Isn't that what we're always asking? Jesus, which one of us is right? Which one of us can be certain that their view on the world is the right one? Now, Jesus says to this group of people hours before he's going to be arrested, remember, he's going to be then beaten and then crucified, and he will die. Hours before that, in John 13, he's having a conversation, and he says this in John 13, verse 34. A new command I'm giving to you guys. Love each other. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everybody will know that you are my disciples. That word can be students, learners, apprentices. This is how they're going to know that you're my disciples. If you love one another. Now, I like to play with inflection a little bit because you can really, really change meaning when you do that. And so I can't prove this, but just listen to this. I normally emphasize love when I read this. That if you love one another, but imagine the context, imagine how different they are, and emphasize the you. It's a plural you. It's a y'all. emphasize that. Here's how people are going to know that you're mine if you love each other. If you guys do. Other people will go, I've seen him swing a sword at people screaming. I've seen this guy on the other side of the table defending himself. And these fishermen, I've seen them shouting in the markets about fairness. How are they all walking around together smiling and talking? How? This is how they'll know you're different. And he doesn't give them any new information. He doesn't give them a list of facts to memorize. He says, here's what will set you apart, that you guys hold together and love each other. It defies reason. It defied anything anybody had ever seen. And people said, I want to be counted among that number. What do they know? I don't know. I don't know what they know, but this doesn't make sense. I want to be part of that because something is tying that together that goes beyond just, hey, let's create a forum. Let's trade facts. There's something magic going on, and I want to be part of that. My wife last week, she made a stew, a chowder, and it was brilliant. It had potatoes and corn, a bunch of other stuff in it, and cheese, and then she serves it, and she really fancy. She made this cornbread, and then she sprinkles cheese on the top, you know, of the bowl, so it had like that ready for the magazine kind of look, and then she lights candles, and the kids were all sitting around, and I'm like, and the whole house just smells wonderful, and so we pray, and then we take a bite, and you know when things are really good, you become French. I don't know why they're like, oh. Like my whole family became French. Like, oh, it was so good. Except Ian, my 6-year-old, my youngest, he goes, puts it to his nose, wrinkles up his face, takes a little bite, and goes, oh, this is disgusting. So I had the appropriate, you know, take that back or I'll end you kind of response. You'll respect your mother. I went through that for a couple seconds. Then I said, Ian, you have to understand, you're saying this is disgusting. What you need to say, even to yourself before you speak, is other people seem to like this. I don't care for it. But as it is, you're making an objective determination. Okay, forget it, you're 6. Don't say that. But see, he was confused. He's like, no, Dad, I don't know what you're saying. This is gross. I'm making a statement of fact here, Dad. This is gross. See, that's cute when you're 6. It's a lot less cute when you're 36. And you start to allow your personal take on reality be the take on reality. Look at this picture. Raise your hand if that looks good. No! It doesn't look good. That's your experience. That looks like poop or mud. There's no way if you had never seen that before, if I showed you that, you'd be, oh, give me some of that in my mouth. If you slid that across the table in a culture that had never seen this before, it would be an insult. There's nothing about that that looks good. Your personal experience is informing your answer. Oh, that looks delicious. No, it doesn't. Not even to an animal. That's your personal experience informing that. Now, that's a kind of a cheap shot, and I think it looks good too. But we have to understand there's something of an arrogance that we get used to embracing that's cute when you're little, but we have to be careful with it when we get older. Ontology is a metaphysical philosophy about what is real. So ontology is the philosophy about what is actually reality, what is actually true. And there's something about my son growing up into the kind of people that you and I both know that you could call an ontological arrogance. There's a way of saying, I am looking at the world and my opinion, my take, my view, my experience is the take, view, and experience on reality. And you lose the ability to properly see where the line where your opinion drops and facts and truth that are true for everybody pick up. We have to be absolutely careful about what we become certain about and how we use certainty to bolster our confidence, to make ourselves feel good, and to draw lines in the sand. Being right feels really good. I like being right. I don't know about you, but I really like being right. I like it when I'm having an exchange with somebody and they say, you know what, after a little bit of consideration, I'm changing my mind, you're right. I'm like, yes. I love that. But there's something I love more than that. It's when somebody disagrees with me, and then they go out, and then they have an additional talk when I'm not there, and then they come back a little sheepishly, and they say, you know what? We read up. We said this. We did this. We thought you're right. Yes, that's even better when you come back and admit it. But my favorite, I confess, is when you disagree with me, you go out, and your thing just explodes, and you crawl back. Oh, that just feels awesome. Now, I'm not saying that's an illuminated, enlightened position. That's by no means spiritual. I'm just confessing, I really like to be right, especially if you being wrong costs you. I'm admitting that. But see, there's something about being right that we have to understand. We're not talking about something like a hobby, like a personal interest. Being right, for many of us, especially in this culture, is we're saying something about ourselves. So if I say, I have to be right, what I'm saying is I'm protecting myself, because many of us, we confuse our ideas with our own heart and other people's ideas with their heart. We think that we're making statements about ourselves because I am my ideas. And so it's not just I have to be right. It's not just, hey, we're just trying to get to the truth and you don't see the truth. Why? You're defending yourself. I'm defending myself oftentimes. That's why if you ever get halfway through an argument and you've changed your mind, your argument has changed, but you're still arguing. It's not about the truth most of the time. It's about me, because I am my ideas. And if my ideas are wrong, what am I? So often, it's not about what can be known. It's about the knower. And we're defending ourselves. It's threatening because I am my ideas. And so we take stances and positions and we get stubborn and we fight for certainty because we think our worth, our life, our personality is on the line. You have to be really careful with that. You've got to be really careful with certainty, because you may achieve certainty at the cost of your relationships. It may happen. And when this comes to faith, when this comes to faith and religion, many of us, we know Jesus said, hey, here's the new command. It all comes down to love God with all you got and love others the way you love yourself. It's all about love. And we all cognitively say, yes, that's true. But then we move it back into second place. We employ love like a luxury. We'll get to love if we can determine that we agree, me and you, or us and you guys. So we know it's all about love, but we immediately give it second place, and it's a luxury to be employed once we create. Do we agree on what we deem the fundamentals? Then we'll put love in there. A lot of us, we do that. Now, this isn't an attack. I just want you to think with me a little bit. We know Jesus said it's all about love of God and loving others as yourself. We know a new command I give you, that this is how people are going to know you're different, that you guys, despite your differences, I'm not saying you've got to agree or disagree, with all of that, that you would love each other. That's how it works. We know this with the fronts of our minds, but think about how you primarily exercise your faith. Regardless of where you are in faith, you're here, so I'll talk to you that way. We know that that's true, and yet we come to a big classroom, and we learn, and then we study by ourselves, and we read, and depending on your nerd factor, you go back into history, sacred history, and we study context, and some of us, we get into discussion groups. We trade ideas. We listen to other people speak about their ideas. We listen to debates. We participate in debates. It's a big exchange of ideas that, if you really think about it, most of our faith, if you watch our lives, looks more like we're trying to get a degree. It's very scholastic. It's primarily, for most of us, academic. But we know, yeah, Jesus said it's all about love, but we've turned it into something that doesn't look a whole lot different than a course. A course that you take, a course, something that you achieve academically, intellectually. Now, that's not an attack. It's an observation, and we have to be very, very careful with that. And so the following statement, I'm saying, as a way of freeing us, of liberating from us from a lot of that. But it takes a great deal of humility to play out how beautiful this is, because you've got to be careful with what we demand certainty on and what we demand from others where certainty is concerned. So this is the statement I want to make. Christianity is about right relationships far more than it's about being right. Start at the beginning of your Bible, go all the way through it. You'll see there's lots of rules and laws and that. But the overarching narrative is about you and I getting life right with each other and with God. It's about right relationships more than it's about being right. Right relationships are far more sacred, they're far more beautiful, and far harder than being right. Way harder. I would much prefer this faith were something where I just got to go be by myself, treat you however I want. Leave me alone. I'm being spiritual. That would be way easier. Right relationships is what this is all about. Now, what that does is frees us from anxiety once we get that. Once we understand what the humility is inviting us into, it frees us from anxiety because now we know where most of our efforts can be pointed. Now, one of the things people would say in response to that, and I hear this a lot, and it's fair, is, you know, what, are you saying then doctrine and facts and information are just, they're meaningless? It's all about just kind of loving each other? No. Doctrine, facts, being intellectual about it, being learned, being academic, that's all very, very, very important. In the scriptures, it talks often about sound doctrine. Sound doctrine is important. But the word sound in Greek means healthy. Healthy has to do with organisms, not lists of facts. Make sure that your doctrine is about people the right way. We did a statement of belief piece this past year. Worked really hard on it because we didn't want to make it so that here's what we believe about this in one sentence, and here's what it takes to be part of Crosspoint, and here's a sentence on this. It's far too important just to give a sentence. So we gave a paragraph or two on different ideas because what we wanted to enforce is this is a conversation. And so here's some highlights to get a discussion started. Because doctrine isn't supposed to just be, you know, a line in the sand, a demarcation. It's supposed to be a conversation. And so you read these and you get the sense of, I want to ask more questions. You're welcome. That's exactly right. They're not lines in the sand. They're invitations to begin discussing and saying, how does this actually apply? What does this look like for my context and yours? Next month, it's not time to register for this, so don't worry about it yet. We'll make some more announcements about this. But next month on Mondays, I'm going to be teaching the book of Acts. On Monday nights, I'm going to teach you the book of Acts. Why? Because it's important. It's important to make sure we're aligned in all the appropriate ways with our sacred tradition and to understand that book and how it speaks to the New Testament, and the story that you're part of. Oh, that's super, super important. That's why we're going to do it. We're excited that to open that registration thing up to you. But all of that serves the main purpose. You and I and you and the people in your row and back home in the state you left a long time ago and you and then all of that and God, that shalom, that sacred circuitry of grace, that's the point. Everything else is a conversation about how that is playing out. Very different than how many of us ever heard. And when you find somebody that disagrees, even fundamentally, now what do you do? Humility says, I don't have a privileged view of reality. Christianity is a privilege with the Spirit of Christ. I want to learn. You disagree. How did you arrive at that? Fundamentally disagree. Oh, wow. How does that work out? Show me how that works out. And a conversation rooted in love ensues. It's an opportunity to learn. Being a Christian does not privilege us to reality. It privileges us to Christ. So I thought of an interesting way to express how this works out in real life. I did a survey last week, and I got 24 responses. They are all Christians. That was the one commonality is that they're all self-professed Christians, and I asked them a bunch of open-ended questions, and then I put all the information together. I chose some of the questions for this morning, and some of their responses. I displayed all the responses. Some of them are just representative responses. I thought it would be interesting to see how, if you talk about theology or daily life practices or even politics, what would it look like just to get a group of Christians together and survey them totally anonymously and get feedback from them. And this is how Christians answered this question. If the presidential election were held today, who would you vote for? And it broke down this way. President Obama, four of them said they'd vote for him, three for Santorum, three for Ron Paul, two for Mitt Romney, two for Newt Gingrich, one for John Huntsman. Any Republican front runner, I thought, dedicated to that ticket, I appreciated that. And then five people said, I have no idea. Pull the trigger. I have pulled your gun to my head. I can't tell you right now who I would vote for. Now, with respect to you all, you may be looking at this going, Christians? Depending on which one you're focused on. Wait. How can this be? How can you be a Christian and vote for? That's a real tension that some of you may be feeling right now. How can that be true? I thought Christians and how to... And other questions, looking at the breakdown of registered Republican, independent, Democrat, or not registered at all, it was all over the map. All over the map. Another question. how do you describe what the Bible is? And they responded this way. These are representative of really what all two dozen responses said. One person put it this way: God's letters to man through men to teach us how to live the way we were intended to live. So guidance on living life. Somebody else said, the inerrant word or wisdom of God, flawless message of God. Somebody else put it this way: a collection of literature from different peoples and different times that God inspired and intended to be read as a story of his people and how he has, is, and will be redeeming them and the world. Somebody else put it this way: the Bible is a rich resource of narratives, songs, proverbs, allegory, metaphor, and a collection of stories that all work to help me listen to what God has to say in my life. It's not a rule book or some cosmic checklist. Rather, it's a historically contextualized group of texts that continues to show me ways to love God and love people better. And somebody else put it this way: the truth, the authority for how we judge what God wants from us and for us. Some people say it's a narrative, it's guidance, it's metaphors, sacred metaphors and teachings that guide us to a life with God through Christ. Other people say, no. It's a flawless set of laws and prophecies that we must adhere to as our authority. Group of Christians, this was how they saw it. Another question: what's your view of the future? Is it fixed? Is it scripted? Is it open to any possibility and you zig, God zags? Is it kind of like that? Or is it a mix of both? Somebody said, ultimately scripted by God. There was a few people that felt that way. That was the most succinct representation. Ultimately scripted by God. Somebody else said, while God knows how the future will play out, I don't believe it's set. So it's open. I mean, God's smart, but it's open. But somebody else said, I think the future is mostly scripted by God, although I do believe that we have free will to make some of the decisions about our life. So it's kind of a mix of both. Two dozen answers, and they were all represented by these three, all over the place. So we got fundamental differences politically. You get people saying, not just, hey, I want to vote for this guy because I like his face, or this guy's got a cool name. Fundamental differences on how you should run a country. Totally different ways of seeing how the world works best. You get people who say, this is how I think things are playing out. It's a script. Everything is choreographed. Other people saying, no, I think it's open and loose, and but God somehow is still involved and he's going to get his way. And other people go, you know, I think it's like it's an amalgam. It's a blend. Another question: what are your views on alcohol? One person represented a lot of them answered this way: moderation's fine. A lot of people had that response. Some said it's best to abstain, cut it out completely. Don't touch it. Stay away from it. Somebody said this: God is great, beer is good, people are crazy. So that was interesting, to say the least. So, all right, another one. A group of followers of Jesus, this seemed important. When it comes to Duke, UNC, and NC State basketball, on whom does God's favor rest? Somebody said, Duke. Somebody said, Wolfpack. Somebody said, UNC, of course, that's why the sky is light blue. Or you can just look at the current rankings. That's smack talk for the uninitiated. God does not favor basketball. I think he's a rugby fan. I like that answer. Somebody said, none, they're all devils, wolves from hell, and sinners with dirty feet, but he does like Baylor. Somebody else said, you can't be serious, and I wasn't. Next. How often do you pray? Big question about how your faith is playing out day to day. How often do you pray? Somebody said this: 2-3 times a day. Lots of numbers given. By about half of them, they gave a specific number. That's how they think of it. They have a regimen, and it's number 2-3 times a day. Somebody else said this: daily. Somebody else said this: no specific number. It's not how I think of it. A lot of people said that. It's kind of an ongoing thing. Somebody else responded this way: a lot of prayers through song. And they went on to describe they listen to music, and they sing, and they think about who they're singing it to, and that's part of their prayer life. A totally different way of looking at prayer for a lot of people. Somebody else said this: short conversations throughout a day, extended periods of 30 minutes or more, maybe happen a couple times a year. So here's a Christian that says, oh, man, I don't get up and stay on my knees for the whole morning. That happens a couple times a year, but it's just kind of an ongoing interactive thing. Somebody else said this. It has become almost continuous running conversation with God, but I stop and pray with focus and try to listen, important, about 2 to 3 times a day. Is there another one? Yeah, totally different ways of looking at prayer. A regimen, a structure, open-ended, fluid, conversational, an amalgam. Totally different ways of seeing how you pray. How often, next question, do you read the Bible? Somebody responded this way. I subscribe to a website that sends a Bible verse to my inbox every morning. I read that every day. This person, follower of Jesus, says, I do it electronically. Somebody else says this. Every morning. This is how I start my day. Every morning. That's my regimen. I read the scriptures. Somebody else said this. Maybe on average 30, 45 minutes a week. Somebody else said, I used to be very inconsistent until I hit on a discipline that works for me. Now I look forward to it and miss it on the now rare occasions I have to skip. Now it's become a fundamental part of my life that I look forward to. Somebody else said this. 5 times a week. I think there's another one. Once or twice a week. Very different ways of going to the scriptures. Very different. You were represented in there somewhere. Now, oftentimes you can get the impression that because I or Jonathan or Stephen, our worship pastor, do most of the vocalizing, that whatever we say that's the view officially held by this church. And some, if you disagree, you feel like, well, this isn't my church. I have a disagreement fundamentally with where you come out on that. That impression, I know it makes sense that you'd have that impression. I want you to know the people I surveyed weren't some random sample. This is the staff at Crosspoint. You're now processing, going back through. What? Wait. What? I did not participate. Don't blame the beer one on me. This is the staff that I have the honor and privilege to get to work with. And we have fundamental disagreements about how the world should work if left up to us. How do we make it work? I'm totally bragging right now. I get to brag on the people that I get to call my friends and my coworkers in that order. How do we make it work? We're not united based on all this stuff. We're pursuing Christ together. And some of us sit on one side of the table and we feel this way, and some of us sit on the other side of the table and we've got a dagger under our coat. We never get out anymore, but it's there. We fundamentally disagree. Christ unites us. I want you to know, you're invited even if you're wrong. Humility, I forgot what series this was. You're absolutely invited if you and I disagree. You're absolutely part of, this isn't my invitation to give. You're part of this, that we all sit at this table and discuss all the myriad things that go with faith, because we're united by the other-centered, self-sacrificial love of a Jesus Christ who was born, taught, died, and resurrected on our behalf. That is what unites us. And in humility, now you can share anything with me. I should be able to share anything about ideas and concepts, because what unites us is our faith in Christ, in Christ alone. That is the capstone. That is how we make it work. When we are certain that we must be certain, you gotta be careful with that. What's at stake? What's at stake to be certain? We gotta be really, really careful. And so here in the next couple of minutes, we're just gonna meditate on that thought a little bit. We're going to think about what the emphasis is understood to be for us. What is it that we think God is demanding of us? What does this life of faith actually look like? What is it that we're supposed to give ourselves to, ideas or to people and people's God? What's at stake? We're going to sit and just think and meditate on this as a good reminder for some of us, and for some of us, it's brand new information. What does it look like to actually love people even if they're wrong?
Towards the sun, towards the sun. took some words and built a wall and called it love, somewhere in all the talking, the meaning faded out.
Heightens our appreciation a little bit to think about the Last Supper when you've got these different views expressed at the table and Jesus unites them and says, I want to establish a beautiful thing called communion, common table, Eucharist. I want you to remember me. And he says, I'm going to give you my body and this picture. Bread represents my body given for you, self-sacrificial love in the most tangible expression there is. I'm giving you me and my spilled blood represented in the drink, the blood of the new covenant, the blood of forgiveness. I want you to remember this, because if you don't remember this, you're going to think that your faith is the sum total of things you can get right and be certain about, and that will come between you. Only way to unite is around love himself. And so for the next few minutes, there's a couple stations up front, a couple on each wall, one in the middle, one in the back. If gluten is an issue, I know some of the bread is in a little protective baggie. To get up, you're going to bump into people and they're nothing like you. But they're binded to you insofar as we're humble enough to pursue Christ and not ourselves and our ideas. So let's stand in the next few minutes, find a spot, and celebrate the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ through the elements together.